You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows on our website, castaway.media.
You're very welcome to episode 2 of Bookish, a new books-related podcast from Dublin in Ireland, with myself, Bob Johnston, of the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar and Dalkey.
And me, Shane Breslin, of Blackbird Books in Navan, County Meath.
So coming up on episode 2, we'll have our start off with a roundup of general news that's caught our eye this month, all things book-related that have gathered our interest. After that, we'll be talking about our book club pick for the month, Anne Enright's The Green Road. And that will be followed by what's looking to be our highlight trilogy, where we invite a guest into the studio to talk about three books that have inspired or particularly caught their eye. Following that, we'll talk about a rediscovered classic, some new books that are due to come out this month, and then finish off with some of the events and happenings that are going on around Dublin and Ireland that are book related. So kicking off first, we have a look at news and everything that's going on in the book world. One thing that's caught my eye this month is a New York Times front page piece, I believe, that came out on September 22nd, talking about how ebook sales have started to slip and that print is far from dead. It was a long piece, actually, a long article by Alexandra Alter. Did you get a chance to look at this, Shane?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not so far yet as having Google Alerts set up for news about ebooks, but it is something that I think all booksellers, it does catch their attention when there's a big piece like this about ebooks and print. It didn't really surprise me. I suppose that you're in this game a bit longer than I am, Bob, but did it surprise you at all, this kind of revelation that the ebook sales seem to have plateaued a little bit and that print is alive and well?
No, I mean, the interesting thing was, obviously, we've always been saying, you know, you can have two things at the same time. Ebooks and printed books can exist, but of course, that doesn't make for a great story. So for the last few years, all we've heard about how print is dead and gone and ebooks are the future. And of course, as ever, these things find a plateau. I mean, I think the interesting thing that came out of the article for me was a lot of the predictions were saying print would be gone by 2015. You know, 2015, print would be wiped out. And it isn't. It's still there and it's still incredibly popular, which is great for us to see as physical bookshops and physical booksellers. But it also just brings in a bit of common sense that says you can do both. You know, you can read both. And I think that's what they're coming across, is that actually even people who love ebooks want to buy print books as well.
Yeah. And like, the ebooks aren't like, They're not going to go away. There's no point wishing otherwise. Like, I'm not even of a mindset that I would like to wish otherwise. I'm not an ebook reader. I never have bought a Kindle, but I know lots of people that do, and that spend, like, you know, they are adopters, or were the adopters of Kindle, and they swear by it, especially for going on holidays or traveling or wherever it might be, that the Kindle has a place or a part to play. Like, it is, speaking to customers who are, and I suppose it is a different in terms of a segment of the audience, the people who come into bookshops maybe are not the best tranche of people to be canvassing opinion. But we've had a lot of people into the shop and say they have never bought Kindle, they're not going to buy Kindle, they really much prefer the tactile touch of getting a book in their hands and picking it up and reading it. We've had other people who have bought Kindles or bought e-readers at various times in the past and now don't use them, or they're sitting there in a corner for a year or 18 months without being picked up. A couple of the interesting things that I found in the article was, I suppose, that digital creates efficiencies. Like, we do know that digital does this, that the slack in any supply chain or everything like that, digital will find a way past that. And it's interesting that in the physical book supply chain, the that digital has helped that to tighten up all those areas. And there was one, I think, well, I'm not sure if it was a Penguin Random House, possibly, that they are now offering this two-day turnaround time in the US for a guaranteed two-day turnaround time at the peak times of the year for delivery of physical books to bookshops. And that, like, they're saying that digital has played a huge part in getting rid of those efficiencies and making that work much more seamlessly. Technology is definitely going to continue to develop. We don't know what e-readers might be in 5 or 6 years' time. I think in some ways e-books have been challenged by technology has overtaken it in a way. I don't know many people who go out of their way to buy actual e-readers now. It's been overtaken by tablets and iPads and all that sort of stuff. That the sales of those are much quicker than your Kindle or wherever you might call it. Like, definitely, and the Sony readers and other like the Nooks, that which we didn't really have, but we've Kobos. I don't sense that many people are buying those.
No, you
now.
Feel those are starting to fall by the wayside now. And as you say, people are reading on their phones or they're reading on tablets instead. I mean, but the great thing for us as independent booksellers, I suppose, is what's happening in the US is that the independent bookshops are the ones that seem to be benefiting, because there was a big cull, you know, with the e-readers, Borders going out of business, the others struggling. And they're saying the American Booksellers Association, they've increased their members from 1,400 up to about 1,700 in the last couple of years. New bookshops opening, new independent bookshops opening, which is great to see. And they quote one independent bookseller there saying, you know, last year was the best year that they had. They were up 11% on the year before. And it's a real positive encouragement that actually people are valuing bookshops and independent bookshops particularly, and going in and using them. So, you know, as I did a little victory dance behind my counter the other day when I read this, you know, the signs are really good, and that's a really positive story.
The last 20 years have seen, like, everything has been binned and started again. It's just such a, like, the pace of change in every area of life, not just books, not just ebooks, but in everything we do, the pace of change over the last 20 years with the internet has changed everything. But I think there's definitely a little bit of a leveling off in that. And I think we live in a physical world. And I think that the journey towards kind of virtual reality has leveled off a little bit. And I think that people, we see that we live in towns and cities where if we don't shop in that shop that's on the corner, that whether it's a butcher or a bookseller or whatever it might be, that might not be there, and then we live in kind of this kind of urban wasteland. I don't think anyone has an appetite
for that.
I
think it's also a switch from that kind of local shopping that's gone from the necessities of going down, you know, and necessities you absolutely have. A lot of people do those in the big chains now, but it's almost like leisure shopping, you know, coming out. One of our busiest days in the bookshop is always Sunday, because people see that as a great browsing day, and it's a leisure activity. You know, you don't have to go in and buy a book in a bookshop on a Sunday. People do it because they enjoy it, and it's a pastime. It's something they enjoy doing. So you can almost see the way that retail has kind of switched into a side that you go for a coffee, you go for a mooch in the shops. You know, it's a kind of, it's a different feel to it, and it seems to work greatly in favor of bookshops, because bookie people love to spend time in bookshops, browsing, spending time there, and finding something new. So fingers crossed, you know, this is a good sign coming out of the US, and fingers crossed, you know, it will continue through the UK and then into Ireland. Their independent bookshops and, you know, people actually supporting physical bookshops continues to grow.
Moving on to one of the other stories that we saw this month, it was a piece by, I think, Michael Barry in the Irish Times about the difficult world of small publishing. And did you get a chance to have a look at this, Bob?
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, going from the nice positive story, but yay for the Irish publishers and a good bit of negativity. In all fairness to Michael Barry, he's an owner of a small Irish publishing, and it was about his experience running a small Irish publisher. And it is an eye-opener, you know, it's an eye-opener about, you know, you physically load books in and out the boot of your car, you distribute them, you cut costs wherever you can, you don't pay a courier, you do it yourself. And, you know, he's got a lot of good points to make, which are around, you know, the survival of Irish publishing and what needs to happen. You know, he says he finds it very difficult to get books printed in Ireland because it's so expensive. So he tends to get them printed in Slovenia, Italy, Portugal, and then ships them over here. He doesn't go to China because of the long lead time. So it's kind of a very good, interesting insight into, you know, how on earth these people make some money. You know, and then he goes on to say, you know, once you've got your books printed, trying to get publicity for those books is almost impossible, you know, and it's all about contacts and all of that kind of way. So I think people sometimes, you don't realise, you know, how hard these people are working behind the scenes just to get a physical book out there, you know. And fair play, you know, we're small booksellers, but small independent publishers are also vital for getting those kind of books out that you wouldn't see from the big guys, you know.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, well, there was a few things that really struck me about this, and it was interesting to read about the need for the literary editor to pick it up and to get that exposure and get that that publicity in I suppose traditional media. It was really what he was focusing on. It was in the Irish Times. It did strike me, now maybe I'm completely naive in this, but it did strike me that we live in this world of social media, and of, I think there's a huge amount of like meritocracy there, and I'm a great believer, again, might be naive, but I'm a great believer that if something is good enough, that somebody somewhere will say it's good, say it's this good, and that their network of friends, whether it's in real life or social media or wherever it might be, will also pick it up and will run with it. And I do think that, personally, I feel that the need for the big splash and to get the literary editor on your side, maybe less than it might have been in the past. But then again, I'm not in that world.
I agree. I think there seems to be a lot of effort put into trying to get a print review in a paper, you know. And I'm not sure that sells that many books these times, you know. So it is actually perhaps, you know, you could spend your time working on other channels to get book interest out there.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the other things was that about the low margins and concomitant low overheads. And I suppose one of the things with low margins is the need for scale, really, to make something viable. And I like, with the best will in the world, I'm not sure if scale is something that's ever really possible for most small publishers Irish marketplace.
You know, when we see even the biggest guys, we were talking Penguin, Random House earlier, two of the biggest guys coming together because they have got to get economies of scale. And you compare that to the small publishers who are literally publishing a few titles a year. Trying to make that work in a profitable way must be nigh on impossible.
It must be, and I suppose that some of the other small publishers that I've seen, and I count maybe the stinging fly in this, that they publish something they really believe strongly in, almost without. I'm not saying, and wouldn't accuse them of being without commercial aspirations, but that isn't at the front and centre of it. And that at some point down the line it might get picked up by a bigger publisher. We've seen that happen over a number of times with The Stinging Fly and Lilliput are two examples of books that they've published and have, once they've succeeded with their independent small publisher behind it, bigger publishers jump in, if in the UK or the US, and kind of do it on a kind of a joint publishing basis then. And I think that might be, that's a model that might help small publishers a little bit in the future. The third item we had was, I suppose, the Man Booker shortlist. Now, we will be getting on to Anne Enright's The Green Road as our book club choice for this month in a second. Anne Enright didn't make the shortlist. She won the Booker Prize with The Gathering in 2007, I think it was, but she didn't make the shortlist this time. Just to run through it very, very briefly, it's a very diverse shortlist. Marilyn James, A Brief History of Seven Killings, that's out of Jamaica. Tom McCarthy, Staten Island. Chikozie Obioma, a Nigerian author with a book called The Fisherman. Sanjeev Sahota, who's a UK author with The Year of the Runaways. Anne Tyler, the veteran American writer with A Spool of Blue Thread. And Hanya Yanagihara, For a Little Life. Is the Booker Prize still... It has traditionally been a huge, hugely relevant element of the publishing year and the books year. Do you think that's still the case, Bob?
I think it is. I think it's still the biggest and the best known prize out there. So, you know, it is one that still captures the imagination. It's the shortlist that we always get asked for, the one that we always sell best on. It's always a mixed bag, I always think. You know, there's always a few authors there that I've never even heard of. You know, they pop up from nowhere and who knows. But it is the one I kind of look forward to, and it kind of sparks interest. I must admit, I've read some of the winners and sometimes wondered why they won, but they do. But it's always one to get good debate, and I think it's one that's out there for the public. You know, there's few book prizes that really capture the imagination. This one does it, and so, you know, fair play. It's an interesting shortlist, as it always is. I've read the Anne Tyler. There's I Do Want to Read a Little Life, which we'll talk about. You know, and there's a few on there I'm hearing really good things about.
Yeah, and I've gone back probably 10, 15 years, I would have read a number of the Booker Prize winners. I'm thinking like Peter Carey's True History of the Kelly Gang, Disgrace by J.M. Coetzee, which I would have really enjoyed those. Over the last number of years, I've read a couple that really like annoyed me more than most books should. And one of them was Howard Jacobson's book a couple of years ago, Finkler Question, which like it just wasn't for me, but it just really, really kind of frustrated me that this could be the main book of the year, or the big book of the year. I'm looking forward to reading a couple of these, and yeah, I think it is a very diverse and internationalization of it is open to US authors over the last couple of years as well. It's definitely something that I'll be dipping into this with interest over the next while.
So that's our news roundup for the month. Up next, we're talking our book club. Anne Enright's The Green Road, long-listed for the Man Booker Prize but didn't make the shortlist. Was that the right decision, Shay?
I'm not sure, because I haven't read any of the others that are on the shortlist. I did enjoy The Green Road. I've kind of a mixed relationship with Anne Enright. It's interesting, a customer came into the shop and this was a couple of months ago, and it was shortly after The Green Road was published. And we had a little bit of chalk in the blackboard about it being the long list. And I think at that stage it had been the long list for the Booker Prize, and the customer said, "Don't give me an Anne Enright. I want a book where something happens."
happens in The Green Road. Stuff happens.
I definitely think stuff happens in The Green Road.
I would say my favourite one about this from a customer was they walked into our bookshop in Dorkey and they said, "Oh, I read The Green Road." I was like, "Oh, how was it?" She said, "Oh, it was good. It was good. Too much gay sex." And I was just like, "Oh, I'll be reading this soon then. Bring it on." There we are.
When I read books of this type, and when I say of this type, maybe kind of non-genre books or literary fiction or whatever you might call it, I do tend to look at the writing and the structure. I try to look at the writing and the structure and what the author's trying to do closely, because I might have harboured ambitions to write something of my own at some point in the distant past. I did like what Anne Enright was doing in The Green Road. The first half of the book is a series of, you might call them vignettes or almost like short stories, each from a different character's perspective, or each detailing a different character. The four children of Rosaline Madigan, and the fifth one is Rosaline Madigan herself. It's the section or the first half is kind of broadly titled Leaving. And I really did love the way these were done, and they were done in different ways. The first one was they're all about the same length, about 30 pages. And the first one was done, it was a really kind of a circular, the time shift on it was something I had to read a couple of times and see exactly how it hung together. And the first six or eight lines of that bit, which was Hannah, were replicated. The last six or eight lines of that were the same,
well,
and it was
noticed.
Just lovely.
Yeah.
The second one was detailing Dan, who is the gay son, and his time in New York in 1991. And it has an unnamed narrator, somebody who's part of the group, who we never see who it is. So I just thought there was lots of interest in
that. She makes writing a craft. You can see it. The way she constructs her sentences, amazing, amazing writing. For me, as you say, the first half, loved. I felt I was thinking about it, you know, especially the bit in New York, the way the plot switches back and forth. I really liked that. The second half, which is the bit right based around kind of the lead up to a family reunion, Christmas, you know, a common scene in books because of all the fraughtness that brings, you know, families getting back together. I could see that coming. There's a great bit with Constance's supermarket trip, which I love, which everybody will relate to, you know, slinging stuff in the trolley, forgetting stuff, having to go back. She's almost like a comedy interlude almost. But as the book kind of draws to a close, there's a big kind of climactic kind of event scene. You know, something does happen, despite what your customer says. But it felt a little bit shoehorned into me. I felt a bit like she she kind of need to end in something dramatic. And I would have preferred almost like an internal explosion within the house rather than external. So
yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I definitely found that the first half of the book worked better for me than the second. I still think I would be recommending it to people who are interested in this type of book. It is something that I think is very well worth reading. It's interesting when I was kind of thinking about the way this was put together and what the devices and things are at play, it was an article that Julian Goff, the German-based Irish writer, wrote a couple of years ago, where he was lamenting Irish books and what Irish books do, and that everyone's trying to be a McGahern. And in the first 20-odd pages of The Green Road, we have the Pope's visit, we have a priest, we have the comb, the mark of the comb through the priest's hair, we have the soft fabric of the priest's coat, we have, in the very first sentence, we have a hot water bottle and the kettle on the range.
Yep.
So there is a lot of the same
tropes, but it's very deliberate.
It moves way beyond that, so it kind of takes that and runs with it in a different direction. It's quite unpredictable in a lot of ways. I think the characters are really well rounded, and I would be recommending it to people. I think it's something that I did enjoy. I would take on board what you say about the second half maybe not delivering as much as the first had promised, but certainly it's something that I would be.
I'd be recommending. Well crafted, well put together, and a good story.
Yeah, and it might be a good little package for. I'm thinking with a bookseller's hat on, maybe at Christmas time, kind of parcel up together with Colin Morrigan's The Book of Irish Mammies and The Green Road. I think the nice complimentary works there. So that brings the end of discussion of this month's Bookish Book Club. Next month we will be reading Hania Yanagihara's A Little Life, which is on the Booker Prize shortlist, as we discussed a moment ago. It is one of the talking book of the year. A lot of people have been praising it to the hilt. And Sarah Crowley, the author and RTE journalist, was on Morning Ireland a couple of weeks ago saying it was the most incredible book she had read in years. So I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that.
So that's Book Club finished off. We'll be right back now with Trilogy.
Trilogy is the part of the show where we invite a special guest from the world of books to talk to us about three books that have played a big part in their life. I'm delighted to say that joining us now is one half of Tramp Press, which is recently celebrated the publication of its fifth book, A Kind of Compass, a collection of stories on a theme of distance, edited by Belinda McKeown. Lisa Cohen, welcome to Bookish.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Your three books that you've picked, we're gonna kick straight into, I suppose, the first one of those, which is J.M. Singh's The Shadow of the Glen, or In the Shadow of the Glen. I've seen the title written both ways. Why J.M. Singh? Why this one in particular?
So I was thinking about what three books would be good, and I started tying myself up in knots about my three favourite books and the three best books, and then suddenly you're in Robert McCrum territory and the self-loathing kicks in. So I just picked three really important ones off the top of my head, practically. I'm a huge fan of 20th century Irish theatre, very interested in that, actually. And Singh is such an important figure, and his work has become... I think it went through a phase of being sort of sanitised museum pieces or stuff that you would see performed in a very perfunctory way or something that you would do in the Leaving Cert. And later, Druid Theatre Company did these great productions of his work that are much more sort of muddy and sexy and interesting. But I think he's still, I don't know, he's just not celebrated enough for the outrageous kind of literary figure that he is. I think I told you guys the Singh connection with Tramp Press, in that when we were trying to come up with a name, we wanted something that suggested an outsider, something a bit upstartish. So Singh had a lot of tramps in his writing, particularly in this play. Mm. The tramp comes in. He's sort of a proxy for the artist in this. And he invariably, this figure tends to come in and disrupt the patriarchy a bit, or disrupt some kind of stale domestic scene. Sort of the Irish equivalent of the cowboy, I think, in Westerns. So that was a nod to Singh, I guess, when we picked the name.
See where your thinking was going there. A bit of disruption always.
Bit of disruption, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about him is he was only active as a playwright for 6 years, really. This was the first of his produced plays. It wasn't the first one he wrote. But he only wrote for another 6 years, and died only, I think, 12 years after Playboy and the riots and everything. But he's such a looming figure. He's so enormous. This was like Ireland, you know, during the Celtic revival, there's this attempt to establish a cultural identity, and people are writing stuff, and Yeats is writing like Kathleen Ni Houlihan and the Countess Kathleen, and then Synge comes along and joins in, and he's studied the Aran Islands and what have you, and he writes these plays that are ostensibly peasant plays. They're set in a kitchen, there's a table, but that's where things then go off, they veer off, and this is what I love about him. So Shadow of the Glen, I think, is a great example. It's based on a story he was told. A man walks into a house and the man of the house is dead. And the wife says, I just have to pop out, or you just sit here with him for a minute. And there's variations on this story. So while she goes out, the corpse sits up. Turns out he's not dead. He says, I have a bad wife. I'm feigning death in order to unmask her infidelities. So the tramp says, fair enough. The wife comes back with some young fella. And in the story Synge was told in the Aran Islands, the young woman, the young man and the wife go into another room, and so the corpse and the visitor get a big stick and they go in and they beat the daylights out of the guy, to the extent that blood splashes up on the gallery. Mm. And that's where the story ends. But Synge changed it. The woman comes back with the young man, but there's a confrontation with the husband in which he wants to throw her out, and there's an argument, and then the tramp tells her, well, come with me and let's go and wander. You know, the husband says, you're going to end up lying in a ditch with spiders in your mouth. And it's really, the imagination is very lurid. This is what I love about saying, really delightfully gross. But the stranger tells her, you know, come with me, and yes, you'll be cold, but you'll have freedom, and sort of does this this very beautiful articulate speech, which I'm clearly not replicating well at all. And she decides to go of her own free will. You know, she walks off with him, and this, the line, it might sound a bit mawkish now, she says, you've a fine bit of talk, stranger, it's with yourself I'll go, and walks out, which was outrageous. Yeah. In what year was this, 1903? Mm-hmm. I think Irish women in nationalist rhetoric were pure and good, and this one was embracing infidelity. She confronts her husband and she says, you know, yeah, maybe I will end up in a ditch, but you'll die soon as well, and you'll die alone. And she walks away from security, domestic stasis, into, you know, chaos, which is outrageous and was outrageous. People were very offended by it.
Moving on to your second choice, Lisa, which is Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which I think was written in
1948.
Yeah. Beg your pardon. And What was it about this one that struck such a chord with you in your reading life?
Oh, this is a brilliant book, and like most of us, I came to Shirley Jackson really late.
Like me, I came to her 2 weeks ago. I just read We've Always Lived in the Castle and wondered why I didn't read it years ago. She's amazing.
It's amazing. She's so good, and you hear of her as being a big influence on Stephen King and Neil Gaiman. She's so much sort of better than the people she's influenced. Mm. Actually. She wrote The Haunting of Hill House, which is this terrific ghost story. People in a house doing seances, and it's all about they're trying to will the ghosts into being. And are there really ghosts, or are they all just mental, you know? Mm. So it's well worth a read. She wrote The Lottery, which is a very famous...
Yeah, which I've heard is literally a one-page short story that you just have to read. I'm going there now. It's one of those, like, right, she's on my hit list now.
It's a bit longer than one page. It's not long, it's a little bit longer than one page, but there's a great recording of it on the New Yorker Fiction podcast that I think A.M. Holmes reading it from a couple of years ago. But leaving that aside and going back to We Have Always Lived in the Castle,
I think this is her masterpiece, and it's not supernatural, actually. It's not a ghost story. It's two sisters living in a house. I think the opening line really says it. I'm going to read the opening line because I think it's the best opening line. My name is Mary Catherine Blackwood. I am 18 years old and I live with my sister Constance. I have often thought that with any luck at all I could have been born a werewolf, because the two middle fingers on both my hands are the same length. But I have had to be content with what I had. I dislike washing myself and dogs and noise. I like my sister Constance, Richard Plantagenet, and Amanita phalloides, the death cap mushroom. Everyone else in my family is dead. How is that for an opening line? It's fantastic. Mary Cat is really weird, very compulsive. She practices sympathetic magic. She has this relationship with her sister that I love. Mm. But she's 18. Constance is 28. They're a bit old. They're living in this house, and their uncle Julian is in a wheelchair and he's very infirm. And it turns out somebody poisoned the whole family, and the villagers hate them. And there's this fantastic scene where Mary Catherine has to go down into the village to buy groceries, and it's you know, it's like a game of snakes and ladders. She's sort of managing it as she goes along.
You never quite know whose mind, because it's told from her point of view, so you don't kind of quite know how much he imagines and how much is actually happening. It's amazing. She really reminded me of Patricia Highsmith, that kind of amorality, kind of, you don't know which way it's going to go. And, it's just so good.
She's very good on the suburban gothic and on that sort of... What I like about it, I like any story where it's an individual against some kind of calcified institution. In this case, she's not, strictly speaking, a hero. And, you know, as the story unfolds, you know, you realise that she's actually, you know, she's a very sinister little figure herself. But you find yourself siding with her. And you think, you know, I hate that when people, you know, arrive at the house unexpectedly to visit. The writing is absolutely superb. The prose is so spotless and it's so tight. And it's... The creeping dread of it is amazing. There is a lot of sort of Freudian undertones, if you want to go down that route as well. It's two women of a certain age in a house, and Cousin Charles comes to visit, and that's where everything starts to go wrong for them. But I don't know that Jackson would encourage that sort of reading of it.
It's interesting that you use the phrase creeping dread there, because I think creeping dread is something that that is clearly apparent in your third pick. Which is Stephen King's Pet Sematary. I think everybody has a favourite Stephen King book. Why is Pet Sematary yours?
I think it's the only one that's still scary now that I'm a big lump of 34. I think when you read his books as a child, they're scary. And I think we all read them when we were too young, right? I don't think anybody read them at an appropriate age. I think this one's still scary. When he published... I think it was Revival last year, he said, you know, stop criticising me for not being scary anymore. It's your fault for not being 15 anymore.
Yeah.
But I still think this is really...
It was a great quote.
It was great, yeah, it was terrific. This one, I remember how chilling it was when I read it. I remember how creepy, and I'm just looking at it now as an adult. I was reading back over it. The death is foreshadowed constantly. And there is this, even just in literary tricks he does with them juxtaposing characters that represent life with, say, the cat. Have you read it, Shane?
No, I haven't read it. I was saying to Barbara earlier on, this is one of the Stephen King ones that I haven't read. I think that The Stand was my
that's a big one to be start with. Yeah, I think I worked my way through them about the age of 13, 14, 15.
So, me too.
That and all the Jackie Collins, God love her. There we are. So, you know, a real introduction to horror, and I think.
I love horror. I think horror is great for shy children. It shows you that monsters exist, but that there are rules around them that you can manage, you know. Although there is kind of a chaos. What I love about the monster in this, it's the Wendigo, which is a Native American mythological monster that if it touches you, turns you into a cannibal. And there's this great, terrible scene with the Wendigo emerging from the mist. I think that you could argue that this is an allegory for white men encroaching upon indigenous land, and you stay within your manicured lawns, and if you try to go over the wall, that's, you know, where things start to fall apart for you, which I love about it. You asked me if there was contemporary work that was still scary, or that I thought was as scary. It occurred to me this morning, Evie Wilde's After the Fire, A Still Small Voice, that has a bunyip in it, which is sort of an Australian equivalent to the Wendigo, which is similarly a monster in the kind of uncontrolled territory. I was kind of slow making the connection because I was thinking within genres. And of course, her books are appropriately, I think, classified as literary fiction, and Stephen King would sort of be out in the cold a little bit. But I think that her books are similarly really chilling and have that same kind of sense of social moral outrage at what has happened, I guess.
Yeah, I think darkness is clearly a common theme in the three books you've picked. We've Always Lived in the Castle, Pet Sematary, and Shadow of the Glen. Have you noticed in sifting through the countless submissions that you guys must get in Tram Press at this stage, that is, have you seen things like that appear on your desk?
Some, but not a lot. I think a lot of the work tends to... I'm wary of misspeaking, but if people aren't, when it's not working out for people, it's when they're trying to mimic what they think you want. So you get a lot of sort of versions of John McGahern, or nowadays versions of Donal Ryan. I'm sure Donal will be delighted to know he's spawned a whole trend. Lots of Flann O'Brien knockoffs, that kind of thing, you know, when it's not working, you know, when it is working, it's original. We would love great genre fiction. I would love to publish some Irish sci-fi. That'd be great. I think then you would show people that they have permission to write it, and then they would. So, for instance, we have The Uninvited coming up as our next Recovered Voices book. That's a ghost story. And I can't tell you much about next year's list yet, but there is a ghost story, a legitimate supernatural story in there.
The Tramp Press goes to the dark side. I like it.
Yeah.
Lisa Cohen from Tramp Press, thank you so much for joining us for Trilogy in this month's episode of Bookish.
Thank you.
We'll have another Trilogy next month, right back after this, and we'll have this month's second look, where we look at a rediscovered classic. Don't forget, you can check out Tramp Press on Twitter at Tramp Press and on the web at tramppress.com. The next part of the show is Second Look, where we revisit a book that we feel may have been overlooked first time round, and we think deserves a little bit more attention. Bob, over to you.
Yeah, this month it was my pick, and I've gone for The Bloody Chamber and Other Stories by Angela Carter, because I'm a raging feminist, obviously. No, it's one of those, I discovered this book first when I was studying English at college. Everybody else had to kind of pick a topic for their dissertations, and they were talking about Thomas Hardy and, you know, D.H. Lawrence and all Dickens and all the classic stuff. And I've always been drawn to fairy tales. I don't know why. Obviously, as a youngster, I was always read fairy tales. We're all aware with fairy tales. And I picked up, it was actually by a science fiction fantasy author called Tanith Lee, who I think died a few months ago. And it was a retelling of Red Riding Hood in a very contemporary way. And this kind of really got me thinking. And I spoke to a tutor, and she put me onto this book, The Bloody Chamber and Other Stories by Angela Carter. Lots of people will know it because it inspired the film The Company of Wolves, filmed by Neil Jordan, with Angela Lansbury as the grandmother, and some very strange goings on indeed. Angela Carter kind of took fairy tales. Now, I always sort of said these were kind of a reworking of the original fairy tales. She actually says she took them as a kind of jumping off point for new stories, and that's what she wanted to do with them. The interesting thing about fairy tales is they speak to our subconscious. They talk about the fears that we have when we're children, about being abandoned, about the death of parents, about violence, all of those things. And they examine them in a way that, as a child, through stories, you can deal with it. As we know through reading books, you can deal with issues that you would maybe not be able to deal with in real life. It prepares you for things. But what Angela Carter does is take these original stories, Little Red Riding Hood, she does Bluebeard as well, and there's various takes on them in the book. She takes them and she explores in terms of A, what it means for female-male relationships, and also what it means, you know, in a wider context as adults compared to as children. So there was a really interesting thing she was saying about them, that she wanted to empower the women in fairy tales, that actually, you know, they were always seen as the way to succeed was to, you know, submit to whatever happened to you. And she said, no, that's not right. You shouldn't submit. You should fight back, you know. And actually in The Company of Wolves, there's a great bit where at the end of the story in The Company of Wolves, you know, the Red Riding Hood tames the wolf, who is obviously a sexual male. She actually tames the wolf and chooses to lie down beside him. And, you know, she calms him. So it's a really, I found a really kind of intriguing sense. It's quite dark. It's quite, I feel like we're having a very dark show this hour with Lisa Cohen's take on, you know, on things. But it's October. What can you expect? You know, the long nights are drawing in. I think we need to talk about some of this dark stuff that's going on. So yeah, I really enjoy that kind of retelling of fairy tales. I really enjoy the exploration of what it does to us as children. There's a great book called The Uses of Enchantment by Bruno Bettelheim, which is seen as kind of the psychotherapist's approach to fairy tales that we now all kind of understand about what they do. And I got really heavily involved. There's a guy called Jack Zipes who is he's US, and he collects these old stories together and puts them in some kind of context. So there's a lot of work that goes on, a lot of kind of academic study into it. But I don't know, Angela Carter was just such a wonderful writer, such an amazing woman, and she had so much to say about females kind of in the 1970s, 1980s. So that's why I chose it for this time around. I thought it would make a good kind of autumnal spooky read. So The Bloody Chamber and Other Stories by Angela Carter was my second look for this month.
Next up on Bookish, we're looking at some new books that are catching our eye for this month.
It's a busy month, isn't it? October is booksellers we love because it's when a load of the big books start coming out for the dreaded C word. We can say Christmas. We're allowed. We're retailers. So lots of stuff hitting. Really hard to pick this month. So much flying around. Obviously, one of my big ones for this month, Kevin Barry, his new novel, Beetle Bone. I have a copy. I have a preview copy. Haven't had a chance to read it yet. It's set on the island that John Lennon bought off the coast of Ireland. I know a little more about that. I think it's expanded from a short story that he previously wrote in one of the In Dark Lies the Island collection. Kevin Barry, wonderful writer. Can't wait to read it. One of kind of Ireland's really good at exploring, Irish culture and the way, and just a wonderful writing voice.
Yeah, a new book by Kevin Barry is a real event at this stage. It is only his second novel, which is hard to believe.
Yeah, I mean, master of the short story, but yeah, exactly, only the second novel.
Yeah, and Beer Trip to Llandudno remains probably my favourite short story of the last half a dozen years or so. Incredible. That's in Dark Lies the Island, I think. My first pick for this month is something that I haven't read it yet. Again, similar to Bob, I have a preview copy at home someplace. It's John Boyne's The Boy at the Top of the Mountain, a new book by John Boyne for children, and not only a new book by John Boyne for children, a new World War II book by John Boyne for children. Completely different story than The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which remains a runaway success from a few years back. This one follows another boy at completely the opposite side of the World War II divide, who spends time. His parents both die young, and he is adopted to the House of the Führer. He spends time in the House of the Führer at the top of the mountain in Austria. It is something I'm looking forward to. It will be a surprise if it manages to match the incredible success of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. But John Boyne being what he is, I would not be surprised if he got huge success with this as well. With The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, he tapped into something that was really interesting globally. And it will be interesting to see if this follows in those veins.
Yep, sticking with maybe the younger type fiction for me, a young adult novel that I've just read, actually, Patrick Ness's new book, The Rest of Us Just Live Here. I am a big fan of Patrick Ness's writing. I think he's great at getting into the minds of teens and how you felt as a teenager. This book works on the premise, as we know, there's so much young adult fiction is about teenagers going out and saving the world. You know, there's schools getting blown up, there's alien invasions, there's vampires to fall in love with. We know how all of this stuff goes. He flips it on his head. Basically, he says, you know, well, these emo kids are all off saving the world, saving everything from disasters. What about the kids who are just calmly getting on with their lives? You know, what about the kids who just want to go to their high school prom and not have it blow up in their faces? You know, it's a really clever take on the young adult novel. It's fantastic for so many reasons. He does deal with issues. He deals with, depression. He deals with being a black teenager in a mainly white society. So he does deal with it, but he's a great writer, so he doesn't deal with it in an overtly in-your-face kind of way. I really enjoyed it. I'm a grown-up. I'd love to say I'm a young adult, but really, I can't be getting away with that anymore. So I'd recommend it across the board. You know, we talk a lot about crossover books these days. read something that you enjoy. This really took me back, actually, to kind of go, you're right, that's how I felt as a teenager. And I think that's always a good thing to explore. And he does a great job of it while having a really good plot and good fun along the way.
My second and final pick for this month, and it is difficult to try and hone it down to two, because there are several hundred books published, I think, on the same day at some point next month, in Black Thursday, I think it's Black Thursday, which happens
Super Thursday.
I did spot the bookselling novice, my first Super Thursday.
For those of you who don't know about Super Thursday, there's always a Thursday in October where a huge number of books are published for Christmas. It's the day. Thursday is the standard release day for books anyway, because they get into bookshops just ready for the big market at the weekend. So Thursdays are always release days, and Super Thursday is when all those big hitters come in. So yeah, look forward to your first Super Thursday, Shane.
I'm really looking forward to it. I'm trying manfully to keep up and failing at this stage. My second pick this month is one that's on the shelves as we speak. It was published a couple of weeks ago, and it was serialised to great acclaim, or there was an extract that appeared in the Sunday Independent a couple of weeks ago to great acclaim. It's a sports book. I'm a great lover of sports books. Lots of sports books get published every year, which I would classify as bland autobiography. This certainly isn't that. It's by Tom English. It's called No Borders, Playing Rugby for Ireland. Tom is a sports journalist. He's an Irish sports journalist. He is based in the UK, I believe, with Scotland on Sunday. They're certainly in Scotland in any case. This one has been timed perfectly to hit the shelves at the same time as the Rugby World Cup. It's a really interesting style. It's almost like a conversation. He interviewed everyone and everybody who were connected with playing rugby for Ireland in around the 2007 World Cup 8 years ago, and it plays out almost as a conversation. I doubt it was a conversation, but it's brilliantly knitted together like a conversation. So you have the likes of Brian O'Driscoll, Jerry Flannery, Eddie O'Sullivan, giving their thoughts on, and really, really insightful thoughts. And it is something that I think the best sports books give insights that we can only ever dream of. And I think this one certainly does that. I think probably you would need a predisposed interest in rugby or in Irish rugby, but I think there's going to be a lot of people out there that will pick this up as the Rugby World Cup continues and that hopefully builds to some sort of climax in late October.
I have to put my hands up and say sports biographies are the one area I still do not stray into in any way. It's completely outside of my world, it has to be said. I'm going to sneak in a couple more just new releases because I couldn't resist. 13 Ways of Looking is the new collection of short stories by Colm McCann, obviously one of Ireland's leading literary authors, so I'm really looking forward to that. Haven't seen anything of it yet, but short stories by Colm McCann, always worth looking forward to. And the other one, which actually you briefly mentioned last month, which has now hit the shelves, is a collection called Long Gaze Back, edited by Sinead Gleeson, which is a collection of women's writings through the years. I mean, it spans, you know, a good 100 years or so. And again, just a beautiful, stunning looking book, ideal kind of gift material, but also just a really impressive collection of both traditional and contemporary female authors, and well worth seeking out. So finishing up for this month, we just have a quick roundup of events and kind of book related happenings going on around Dublin and regions. First one up for me this month, we're at the Dublin Festival of History, actually this weekend, Saturday the 26th and Sunday the 27th of September. Based in Dublin Castle in their Printworks venue, it's a whole range of talks on historical subjects, everybody from Stella Tillyard to 1916. A whole raft of historians in there, so looking forward to that one.
My first event, I'm picking two public lectures, and I do love a really well put together lecture. The first one that I'm looking at is by the Royal Irish Academy. It's on Thursday the 22nd of October. It's titled Burning Books. It's delivered by Professor Lindsay Stonebridge, who's Professor of Modern English Literature at the University of East Anglia. University of East Anglia has played a big part in lots of the development of lots of writers through their creative writing programme. This is at the Royal Irish Academy. It is about how writers in the 20th century dealt with statelessness, the Holocaust, enforced exile, migration, the relationship of human rights to modern and contemporary literature, and it is kind of an intersection of law, politics, and literature. So I think it's something that certainly I'll be interested. I'll be trying to get along to that on Thursday, 22nd of October.
Lovely. Well, next up for us, we have Jonathan Franzen, the infamous Jonathan Franzen. He's over in Ireland. He's doing an event at the RDS in Dublin on Monday, the 5th of October. We'll be there with lots of copies of his big hefty new book. Tickets are still available. It's organised through what used to be the Dublin Writers Festival, is now called the International Literature Festival of Dublin, or ilfdublin.com to get tickets for that one. So I'm looking forward to talking to Jonathan Franzen. I think it'll be an interesting evening.
Will he talk to you though? The second public lecture that's happening this month is in that caught my eye anyway, is in the University of Limerick at the end of the month, the 28th of October. It's titled Yeats and the Occult, and it's delivered by Professor Margaret Mills Harper, who's director of the Yeats Summer School. I think it's something that would be of interest. It's certainly it's not one of these kind of broad Yeats 150th anniversary lectures. It is very clearly along the lines of a very specific bit. But I think that it'd be interesting for anyone in the kind of the Midwest or around Limerick that might be something worth getting along to. And if I could selfishly shoehorn in something related to Blackbird Books on the 29th of October, we have one of our first author readings event and signings, and we have Jax Miller, who published Freedom's Child, published this year by HarperCollins, and we also have Newell O'Connor, whose excellent Miss Emily is on the shelves now. Both of those will be in Blackbird Books and Navan reading and signing books on Thursday, the 29th of October.
Both great writers, actually, love both of those. My final mention is the Books Are My Bag campaign. This has been going a couple of years now. It's a campaign just to remind people about the wonder of physical books and physical bookshops and what we do. So there's a tote bag you get to carry your books around in, a Books Are My Bag. It ties in with Super Thursday, which we've talked about, when a lot of the big new books come out on the 8th of October. And then a number of shops will do kind of in-store events, you know, everything from face painting to story times to author signings to cake. Everybody loves cake. There's also a limited edition Grayson Perry. The artist Grayson Perry has designed a special limited edition bag for this year. I don't believe there's going to be an awful lot of them in Ireland, but they should be available. So contact your local bookshop to see. But Books Are My Bag is kind of taking over 8th, 9th, 10th of October.
So that's just about it for the second episode of Bookish. We'll be back at the end of October with episode 3. But in the meantime, make sure you keep up to date with everything that's going on. Check out the website, which is castaway.media/bookish. You can follow us on Twitter at Bookish Podcast. And you can subscribe to us in iTunes or your favourite Android podcasting app. You should find us there. So that's about it for this month. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
Thank you.
This was a Castaway Media production. Find us on Twitter at Castaway Media or on Facebook, facebook.com/Castaway Podcasts.